Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Contractor Evolution. My guest on the show today is our very own coach, Ian Owerkirk. Many of our members who work with Ian love him, but few know his story. On August 29th, 2008, on their way home from a wedding, Ian, his mom, and his dad were T-boned by a car going 70 miles an hour. His carotid artery was severed. He broke both his collarbones, 11 ribs, and the list of injuries goes on. He also died and came back multiple times through this harrowing event. Today's conversation is about his story and the life lessons he's learned as a result. We talk about how to cultivate resilience, perspective, and faith in life's most challenging seasons. I really hope you enjoy this conversation. Let's dive in with Ian. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, brother. It's a long time coming.
It's a really good to see you. We chat all the time. You're one of my best friends of all time, and we finally get to have a conversation that everyone else can hear. So we're going to talk about your story today. And there's some lessons that are sort of bolted onto the back of it. We're going to save that for a minute or two from now. But for the unacquainted listener, who are you? And more specifically, who are you to kind of the Breakthrough Academy universe? Can you just set that up for the audience?
Yeah, so I've been a part of the BTA group now for 6 years. And through that time, I've kind of niched into our group programs. And I work with groups of business owners. They range in the amount of revenue they're working on every year from $500,000 to $15 million.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, they're all good people trying to gain two things, time and profit. Mm-hmm. And we are constantly working through the group, through the mastermind, through myself and other experts to try and get that for them.
Can you maybe elaborate on the type of perspective, the unique vantage point on the industry, on entrepreneurship, on business trajectories and growth that you would have? Just, you have a bigger sample size. I mean, every BTA coach kind of has a unique lens, and you within the Breakthrough Academy coaching group have an even more unique lens just because of the sheer volume of businesses you work with currently and have worked with over the past few years. Can you maybe put a finer point on the perspective that that gives you compared to the general population?
Totally, yeah. We have, you know, at any week of the year, pretty much, I'm working on 4 to 8 groups of anywhere from 30 to 90 entrepreneurs, usually.
Yeah.
And half of my week, at least every week for the last 6 years, has been working with these groups of entrepreneurs. And in that time, I probably witnessed them deliver probably in the billions of revenue. And I get a unique perspective because I see hundreds of people learning things together, bringing things to the table. And I think that what's cool about it is every day there's something to learn from someone else. And I'm just kind of like guiding the process, let's say. But I get to be a part of a lot of people learning how to run their businesses better. You know, I've probably seen a few hundred businesses now go through the BTA framework. There's currently hundreds as well that I'm kind of walking through that journey with.
Yeah.
So I see it's a large sample size. I see a lot of things done well, a lot of things done not so well.
Yeah, and everything in between.
And everything in between, yes.
Your coaching philosophy, when you work with a member, what's a win for you? Like what are you, how do you quantify? We can do this in a very like empirical data-based way and say we want to get net profit above 10% and ideally 15%. Like I feel like we've kind of talked about that enough on the podcast. Like people kind of get what we're about. I'm sort of talking more philosophically, more kind of core values. Like, what are you trying to do with the Breakthrough Academies that you work with?
Yeah, I think so. I witnessed this, you know, from a young age with my own family. You know, I saw somebody, my dad, who was, you know, very, very, very hardworking and, you know, too hardworking. Mm-hmm. And I've taken some of that on myself for sure. You know this.
I do.
But I'm very aware of the fact that This is a two-pronged victory, in my opinion.
Okay, I like that. Two-pronged victory. What does that mean?
So that means I want you to hit your goals in life financially. Obviously, that's very important to you. It's important to your lifestyle, right? To me, that's one half of the equation. The other half is, are you spending your most valuable asset, your time, doing the things that you really want to be doing, spending that time with the people you really, really value?
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's equal importance.
Have you had enough reps at this to say with sort of the utmost confidence that you believe in an and paradigm? In other words, like, you can be super successful financially in your business, great, build a company that you're really proud of, that your people love working at, that your customers enjoy, and also be a great dad, be a great mom, be a great community member, have the balance part too.
Totally, man. That's one of my mantras in life. Why not both?
Right. Okay. Right?
Why not both? Why can't we have both?
Right.
I think you deserve both. Otherwise, yeah, it's not worth it in either direction.
So that's what you're about. That's what we're trying to do at BTA more broadly. That's what you do more specifically with your groups. You've got a really big sample size to pull from. We're going to get into your story here starting in a second. But before we start with sort of the opening scene, what are you hoping that people take away from this narrative we're about to tell? Because it's a pretty profound, pretty juicy roller coaster ride we're going to go on. What do you want people to be listening for?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a part of these journeys with many business owners now. Everyone goes through seasons in life that are painful.
Mm.
Could be physically painful. Could be relationships are falling apart. It could be your business is floundering. Everyone goes through these seasons that are painful. And, you know, I went through one of these seasons, still go through these seasons. We all do. This one's particularly dramatic, I'd say. But what I hope people take from this is fresh perspective,
mm-hmm,
a little bit of inspiration maybe,
mm-hmm,
and hopefully, you know, a little bit of faith as well. Just a little boost to faith in yourself, faith in God,
yeah,
faith in others around you. And I think if we can do any one of those today, we're in good shape.
There's the thing that happens. There's the season that you're going through. There's the event. There's the divorce. There is the death. There is the ailment. There is the bankruptcy. There is the key employee leaving, whatever. And then there's the response to it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of hoping to give people some framing for the response. There's not a lot we can do about what happens to you. We'd like to maybe give some insight on how to respond to these things in the best possible way to maybe not make the bad season worse, because that's often what people do.
Totally. Yeah. What can you learn from this? Maybe. And, you know, I want to share some of the things I've learned about this. It's, you know, some of these things took 16 years to learn.
To unpack. Okay. So 16 years. Let's wind back the clock. August 29th, 2008.
Yes.
Let's start. What happened?
August 29th, 2008. So this is the date. This is a famous date.
Is it?
It is. Princess Diana, rest in peace, passed away on this day. So it's actually...
Do you know what year?
I don't know what year.
But it was August 29th.
Okay. Yes. So Bluebird Day, beautiful day, perfect day.
It's a great time of year.
Everyone
loves a good August 29th. I'm a fan.
Dude, end of August...
Totally.
You know, is everyone's happiest time of year. You get to Labor Day... My favorite weekend of the year.
You're feeling no pain. You've had a good summer. You're kind of like over the heat. You're not hating the idea of some cooler weather. You got a good tan by then. You've got a tan. I hear you. Okay.
Yes.
This is a nice day. End of summer. Gotcha.
End of summer. My parents and I are getting ready to head out for a wedding. I did not want to go. I did not think that this relationship would last. But, you know, your parents say you got to go somewhere, you go. So I did. They didn't last.
Told you.
So I was right.
Yeah.
But, so we, you know, we all get ready. We're heading out. My brother was already there. He was actually the best man.
Okay. So he's in the wedding party. Driving separately.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So we're driving separately. My parents and I, we're making the journey south. It's about a 2 or 3 hour drive. And, perfect, you know, just one of those days you kind of like get excited for, right? We are just coming through this little town. This is actually the town that my dad grew up in. Port McLeod, it's called, in southern Alberta, for any of our
this is small
southern
town,
Alberta friends.
This is small town.
Small town.
Yeah.
Small town. Cute little town, though.
Yeah.
And we come just outside of town, just south of this town. There's this place where there's kind of this natural blind spot where these two highways kind of meet.
Okay.
Okay? And my dad, he's driving, he's doing his thing. And this guy, I don't know why, still don't know why, but he's going a buck 20 in a Ford Explorer, comes through a couple of sets of rumble strips, through a stop sign, and boom, just hits me and my dad, basically. Hits me, like T-bones us. Hits me sitting there. I'm behind my dad.
Your mom's in the car?
Mom's in the car as well. Hits us. Boom. But at 120, so fast that he basically just shoots off over top of us, lands upside down in the ditch.
What side of the car were you impacted on?
So we were hit on the left side.
Left side.
Of the car.
You're in the you're in the rear passenger, left rear
driver's
seat.
Side.
Driver's side. Side rear.
Yes.
Mom's front right, passenger, dad's driving.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Gotcha. Car smashes you guys, careens over or spins out. You guys spin out, he goes over you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so he basically ends up in the ditch. We just spin. I remember basically up to a certain point, the gas station we stopped at before all this happened. Mm-hmm. I kind of have flashes of out of body and then I wake up in the hospital. That's kind of like
the quick one, the quick synopsis,
the quick synopsis.
Talk about the out of bodies.
Yes. So the one I remember on scene is where basically, I'm kind of looking down at myself on this side of the road, like bird's eye view.
Bird's eye view, yeah. Almost like a video game character,
exactly.
But further up, higher up.
Yeah.
Six feet in the air, 10 feet in the air, something like that.
I'd say more like 20.
Okay.
I'm like up there a little
You're
bit.
You're up there on a tree branch.
Yeah.
Looking down on the
exactly.
scene. I got you. And what do you see?
I see myself just kind of laying there like a shadow, basically, like I'm gone or about to be gone. And, I can see myself there, and I look, I can see, you know, like you kind of go towards the light, and I do, I go towards the light, and it is like, it's all the things they say. It's calm, it's peaceful, it's beautiful, but I'm not happy to go there. I'm mad.
Right.
I am furious that I am.
I know you well enough.
I do not want to go. I've got too much to do. Yeah. I've got too much to do. And I have too much to live for. And I was just angry, furious. So I kind of like, you know, start to feel that. And then the weightlessness, boom. And that's kind of the end of it.
Okay. Could you see your parents in the scene?
I can only see me.
Okay.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's just a glimpse, really.
You come to hours later, days later.
So I had multiple resuscitations. So I was kind of like brought back to life a number of times. I wake up in the hospital. I am like attached to 24 different tubes and monitors.
It's like a movie scene.
It's a movie scene.
Yeah.
I'm actually kind of upright. I got the neck brace on. I'm just sort of like a locked in, basically. I can't really move. I can't talk. I can just kind of like glimpse around a little bit, but I'm just like locked in. Because they don't want you moving, right?
Yeah.
So when I wake up in the hospital, I'm just sort of kind of coming to. They had already told my mom, my brother, that I would probably be a lot different.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be able to speak or be coherent, or I'd probably be a different person, right?
They're prepping the family for terrible news and a completely different life from here. And they're I'm sure that you're extremely well trained in the medical field to sort of have these conversations early and often and just make sure that expectations are set correctly.
Exactly.
And that's kind of what they're doing. He's not going to be the same Ian.
No. Yeah, exactly.
So how many days later was it?
4 days later. So they put me in a coma.
Okay.
Intentionally. During that time, I had like organ failure, which is usually a sign you're kind of on your way out. But I kind of hung through that. I did get, you know, when they have all those tubes hooked up to you and stuff, you get all these different things going on. You know, you have pneumonia from the trach tubes and things like that, and lots of other things happening. But I wake up. I kind of like look around the room. Nobody was expecting that. I think I was still supposed to be in the coma. But I kind of like, you know, start looking around. And this guy, this nurse, he starts seeing me kind of come to. He's like, he shocked him, I think.
Yeah.
He's like, whoa, you're not supposed to be awake, dude. And I obviously couldn't talk because I, you know, you're full of tubes, yeah, basically. And I asked, I kind of motioned for a pen because I couldn't talk, but I did have some things I wanted to know.
Yeah.
And
understandably. I got a couple questions.
I got a couple things that I would like to dig into.
I'm curious here. Yeah. What a few things.
So I motioned like I want to write something. So they bring me a pen and a pad, and I wrote parents, like what happened to my parents. So they explained that. I wrote where am I? Because I don't recognize any of this. And then I wrote no plug. And they kind of like had to figure that out for a minute. But like they put it together. They're like, I kind of like had to scratch it a couple times, I think. And they're like, we're not going to pull the plug on you. We're not going to pull the plug on you, dude. Don't worry.
Is that what you were scared of?
I was like, don't pull the plug on me. Don't give up on me.
Oh my God. I never heard this part of the story.
I'm coming back. Yeah. I'm coming back. Please don't give up on me. And they wouldn't. And so No, don't worry. We're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. Rest easy, son. And then just kind of turned up the dial on my
whatever they're giving you. Whatever, yeah. Let's put this guy back to sleep. That's really funny.
Yeah.
The story is obviously not funny, but that moment is you're like pissed. You're going towards the light and the warmth. Like, no, I'm pissed off about this. And then when you do come to, you're like, please don't bail on me.
Don't bail on me.
It's like, Ian, it's all good. We're actually trained to do everything but.
I know. Yeah, I know. Paranoid even in my half consciousness.
So what... like anything else like with this nurse or like sort of that coming to moment that you want to share?
No, I mean, that was, you know, one of those moments that you kind of never forget.
Yeah.
Right. It's very, I can still picture it. But it is like, it's impactful, but you know, there was a lot that happened, you know, once I did actually fully kind of get pulled out of that coma a couple of days after that still. That's when I really realized how much had all happened to me.
Yeah.
And all that had, changed.
So let's do an inventory of the injuries of the, what you were told. There were a couple, like, I think fully sort of certified NDEs, near death experiences, some die and come back moments. Let's just go through kind of the grocery list of the state you were in.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, so there were multiple moments of resuscitation. So I've never been given a count. I don't think they count. They just keep trying to keep you alive. But
they stop counting at one.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
They just go from one to multiple.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So four, you know, at the worst, the longest I was sort of out for, 4 minutes without a heartbeat, 5 minutes without a pulse. So when we got hit, as best we know, the glass shattered, went kind of like all, it all happens in a blink of
so
an
fast.
Eye. But glass shatters between the seatbelt and my throat, just gets right in there.
Right. And you still have that scar. People are listening. Yeah, they can't see this, but you can probably see it if you're watching on YouTube. And if you've ever met Ian, it's quite a prominent, I mean, it's very rugged and handsome now, but you do have a big scar on your neck and always have.
It's true.
Yeah, that's what that was.
Yeah, so
Windshield glass cutting your...
Exactly. So side window, boom, gets in there, and basically it slices my carotid artery. So I bled out.
That's the big one too, by the way, guys.
That's the big one. Yeah. That's the one that delivers all the blood to the brain.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. So carotid artery... basically severed. That was the biggest trauma. They were obviously very worried about.
For sure.
Because, I mean, even the guy who was first on scene, I met him years later, and he said, He didn't recognize me. It was just a sheet of blood, like blood everywhere.
Yeah.
So I got a full oil change. It's all new. All this blood in here. New.
Full oil change. They should call you Mr. Lube.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
maybe call them for sponsorship.
Yeah.
So that's a big one. That's a big one. But yeah. Your body, your skeleton, I mean, there are breaks.
And yeah, man. So
ligaments. Tell us about like the rest of the fractures.
Yeah, I had like 20 to 30 breaks and fractures. I don't know the exact number because it's all, so 11 ribs, both collarbones.
Oh my God.
I had vertebrae in my neck broken, nose, jaw, skull, facial, orbital bones. Basically just like a plate that drops and just stays in place, but it's broken, right?
Yeah.
So all kinds of fractures and breaks and bumps and bruises. Like I'm black and blue. Everything is different than it once looked, right?
Internal bleeding?
I did. So I had my spleen removed. They did a full laparotomy. So they took the spleen out, checked for any other internal bleeding. They basically cut you open from like here down to the base of your stomach and pull you all open, make sure everything's okay, and then they let you heal from the inside out. So you're kind of open in air for a while.
They don't stitch you up right away?
They do, but they want it to heal from the inside out.
Huh.
So like you kind of have this just massive gash, zipper. Yeah. Like a big zipper down the middle of your body. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So that was obviously quite shocking. It's just like just a lot of flesh there that you're not used to seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Just a massive amount of brain trauma. So like you can imagine like when you get hit that hard, the brain just kind of snaps against the side of the skull and sort of bounces back, right? It's very elastic, but thunk thunk, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of brain trauma. The worst part of all that was an aneurysm that basically, it's like an internal bleed in your brain. Mm-hmm. And at worst, they have to like go in and surgically repair it, in which case you're never the same. At best, it heals on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So that aneurysm was, yeah, probably some of the most pain I've experienced. I remember like I would move my fingers. My whole body would just like shake.
Mm-hmm.
It was just unbelievable pain. They say it's one of the most painful things you can.
An aneurysm. Experience.
Yeah.
Huh. I didn't know that.
It's think about like, you know, basically like something inside of your brain, like expanding or bleeding.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but for me at least, it was just incredibly painful. And they do say that aneurysms are one of the most painful things you can experience. But it for me, it was just vividly painful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How long were you in the hospital with all this stuff?
4 weeks.
Talk to me about those 4 weeks.
4 weeks, which it actually doesn't seem like that long, all things considered. But a lot of work during that time, just keeping you alive. And through that time, they're doing all kinds of testing and checking and, you know, oh, I didn't realize, like, you know, it wasn't 3 weeks later they found out that there were certain breaks that they didn't know about. Like, mm-hmm. I remember I kept complaining, like, I can't grab things. Like, what's wrong with my hand? Oh, your thumb's broken, you know? There's so many things that they don't even really quantify it all at once, right?
At a certain point, they run out of paper on the list, right?
Exactly.
Like, oh, yeah, no, and by the way, like.
Oh, yeah, that too, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, it's just the nature of something that traumatic happening. And they would put you through all these different tests. Like I remember one night to stop the bleed in the brain, they did, they basically try and go in through one of the main arteries in your groin and they try and put in a balloon to stop the bleed, artificially stop the bleed. And I remember, I mean, I took my identity from my intellect, my grades, my religion, and my looks. And so when they asked me, when they put that balloon in and they asked me to count backwards from 100, In that moment, I was like, wow, they really do think I'm retarded.
Yeah, I'm gone.
It's a bad word to use, yeah. I guess, now, but they really do think I am done.
Permanently brain damaged. Yeah. Never going to be the same.
So they asked me to.
Quasi vegetable.
Yeah, exactly. So they asked me to count backwards from 100 as they try and put this balloon in. And I'll never forget it, man. I was like, you know, got back. I think it was in the 80s somewhere. And all of a sudden, like, they put this balloon in and I had nothing. I couldn't count backwards anymore.
Yeah.
It was so scary.
Yeah. Like the realization that you couldn't do 99, 98, 97.
Just blank, full blank. When they put that balloon in, it was full blank. It was terrifying. Because you know you're supposed to know.
Yeah.
But you don't know.
Yeah.
And I, you know, shocked. And they realized that wasn't going to work. So they abandoned that idea. They did four of those. So they basically tap into this main artery in your groin, the biggest one you got. And they'll send a camera. They'll shoot dye or they'll just try and test,
yeah,
you know, through that. And it's kind of gruesome. You know, you're not supposed to move your leg for like a few hours after, because if it kinks or snaps and you start to bleeding, like they can't stop it.
Yeah.
And you'll be dead.
Yeah.
So you're just like laying there parrot, like just terrified that you're going to just snap open. But so that, yeah, they're just this few weeks of just testing and more testing. And I remember, dude, there's so many moments. Like I remember there's a like a type of trauma induced, like extreme diabetes essentially. And they wouldn't let me drink. Like I couldn't actually drink anything.
No water.
No water.
Anything.
Mm-hmm. I remember they would just kind of like sponge you. They'd give you a sponge. I remember just like begging my brother for more of the sponge. Because my nose is broken. It's packed tight. Mm-hmm. So you're mouth breathing constantly, but you can't drink anything.
Yeah.
And you're just in a desert.
What's going through your mind over these 4 weeks? Like, what are you like... What kind of mindset do you have? Are you optimistic? Are you hopeful? Are you like, my life is never going to be the same? Maybe I do want them to pull the plug. Like what's going on in your brain in that month?
I mean, for me at least, I was angry.
About what? Just the fact that it happened?
I was angry at the fact that it happened. I was angry that everything seemed like it was going to be different.
Right.
Or never the same. I was angry because I was... Yeah, in my own eyes, I was like, I was kind of an ugly dude all of a sudden.
Right.
You know, I had all these scars and I was black and blue and swollen and chunks of hair missing. And, you know, you're just sort of embarrassed.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're terrified because, you know, you've had these moments where your brain just isn't working.
Yeah.
It's not working. And you're not sure if it's ever going to work again the way it did. And you're in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
And you feel alone a lot of times.
Is there anything that you held on to in that section that just helped you get through it? Was there a mantra, a prayer, a belief system? Was it family support? Like what were some things that you maybe found useful?
One of the things that got me through it was definitely my brother. He never left my side basically the entire time I was there. He did everything he could to try and make it livable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know what it's like when, you know, when your brother's kind of like laying there almost dead and mm-hmm. you're trying to like, you're withholding a sponge from him because the nurses told you not to.
It's a pretty weird experience.
It's heavy.
Yeah.
It's heavy. So, yeah, I think, you know, my brother was one. I think, you know, I've always believed strongly in God.
Mm-hmm.
And that definitely, you know, on one hand, you're so angry at God that you're there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, in my case, you know, I thought I had lived so well, you know, that...
I don't deserve this.
Yeah, you know, I don't deserve this. Yeah. How come this is happening to me? Like, yeah. I always try to do the right thing. I was always trying to be good. You know, I was always trying to do the right thing for people and... and live healthy, all those things. And then you're there and you're like, you know, there is a bit of like, well, why me?
Yeah, you know? the injustice of it all.
Exactly.
You know, they say a lot about these massive injuries that there's quite a bit of, like a huge amount of the prognosis and the outcomes depend on the patient and their own like resilience and toughness and ability to kind of, you can distort reality to some degree, bend it to your will based on how badly you want to get out of there, how committed you are to the process, how clearly you see a vision for yourself and your life after this event. Were you like, talk about the maybe getting back on your feet stage of this. When did you get out of the hospital? What did you go do next? How did you kind of get back into life?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think I'm lucky, I suppose, because I've kind of like, maybe it's the Dutchman in me or something. I can be stubborn. Mm-hmm. And I kind of, you know, during that, you know, that period when you're out of the hospital, that first year especially, it's just millions of appointments. It's like constantly talking to professionals and them doing their job and basically, you know, preparing you for the fact that you'll never be the same or probably even close to the same. And you know,
that conversation was not just sort of like day one or day two in the ICU. That was like the next year. You're still being told, hey, like you're probably not going to be able to remember the same way and you may not be able to synthesize information. You may feel different socially, all this stuff.
Exactly. Man, like it was just meeting after meeting, appointment after appointment, just, you know, they're obviously preparing you for the worst. Right. And doing their job and explaining, well, you know, all of these things that you do need to know. But after a while, you just start to, you know, you just start to get so defeated.
Did you start to believe them?
I did start to believe them. But then I also like, you know, another mantra worth living by, I think, is like, you can prove them wrong or you can prove them right. And I decided I was going to prove him wrong because I did not want to be that version of myself mm-hmm. for any amount of time, let alone the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, you would go from being a 4.0 student and everything comes really easily. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, you got to focus on it, but focusing is easy. You know, everything comes to you pretty naturally. You don't have to work that hard, right? You go from that to basically just having to relearn how to learn. Mm-hmm. Nothing comes easily. I remember getting lost. You know, just walking around the university that I knew so well. I got lost.
Didn't know where
like
you were.
Like a little kid.
Yeah.
I was just like, I was like, can you help me?
Any other like cognitive stuff that you remember?
Man, the worst I think was trying to have conversations, trying to remember stories, trying to, you know, just live, right? And I would constantly get halfway through sentences and
trail off, forget, yeah.
Forget, could not come up with the words. And it was just over and over. And it just,
awful.
It's just driving me
embarrassing.
Crazy. It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is because you're constantly.
And you're a smart guy. Everyone knows that of you. So that would be especially.
It's painful.
Yeah.
And mostly it's embarrassing. Like it's just constant jabs at your ego and your self-worth when you're trying to get through a sentence and you can't even finish it.
Because you know that's not you.
That's not me.
Yeah.
No. And, you know, that and, you know, going through classes and just, you know, not being able to focus, you know, trying to like kind of like feel your body again. Cause I was in really good shape, man, like really good shape. And I was a gym rat. I was in there all the time. I was, you know, sometimes I'd have like, you know, 2-3 hour sessions, just
you're
going
fit.
Hard.
Yeah.
And then from that to like, you know, lost 40 pounds in like 4 weeks.
In the hospital. Yeah.
So you're like, you're 40 pounds lighter. You've got all these scars and limitations and you can't do certain things. You can't breathe certain ways. Everything hurts. Nothing works properly.
Yeah.
And you start, you know, worrying like, is this going to be where I end up? Like, is this going to actually be who I end up forever?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Like I've known you a long time and I'm not, I don't think I'm giving away the ending here by saying this, but, you know, when we go houseboating or we're doing stuff in the summer, we're doing social stuff and you take your shirt off, it's visible.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know if you know that. No offense. I know you're really, you know, secretly vain guy. You don't
hear
this.
Oh, but yeah.
It's, I mean, you know, I'm a pretty observant person. And yeah. I always notice that you've got the scar under your tummy is still there. Your shoulders are kind of wonky. One is forward and one's back. And, you know, a scar on the throat, some stuff on the back. Like, it's just, you can, it looks like you got absolutely walloped by a car going 120 kilometers an hour.
Yes.
And spent a month in the hospital.
Yeah, man. And there's still.
And you like to tell the tale.
Oh, man. I mean, you can see it. There's still like chronic pain. There's still issues. Yeah. Like, did my body ever get back to what it was? No.
Yeah.
But I mean, luckily that happened in my 20s because I mean, it happened to my dad in his 50s and he didn't fare as well. So.
So let's move forward. Like what you're out of the hospital, you kind of come out like this mummified version of Ian, but you're really committed to not stay there. And you want to get back. There's a sense of urgency, I guess, to kind of prove them wrong, get back to your old self. What steps did you take? Were you back to school? When did the business stuff kind of start to take off for you?
Yeah. So, you know, as I'm kind of like getting all these opinions and starting to worry about where I'm going to end up in life, I decided I got to start challenging myself. And I really want to be the best version that I can possibly pull out of this new version of Ian.
Yeah.
So I start doing things that are uncomfortable.
Like?
So I got involved in like different business competitions. So we would do case studies. So I just practice talking and practice like embarrassing myself, missing the ends of sentences in front of people. And I would just get out there. I'd get uncomfortable and I would embarrass myself and I would challenge myself to just keep getting better and better and keep trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. So I joined it's an annual thing. They do business case competitions and we were just trying to solve problems and give presentations in a specific window. It really is a ridiculous task if you think about it, because when are you ever going to be trapped in a room without internet? And not be able to look up certain facts.
These university case study business thingies. Here in Canada, they're called JDC.
JDC, yeah.
JD, and I think they probably have an equivalent in the States.
Yep. So I was doing that stuff. I through that, I actually met, his name is Leighton Healy, one of my first mentors. And he was part of this organization called College Pro.
Yeah.
And I went to him, actually, and I said, like, hey, I want to try something to see how far I can go and see, you know, without a ceiling, you know, how high I can climb and just do everything I can to prove myself in something.
Yeah.
So it was basically, you know, they taught you, they called it at the time, they sold it as like a 6-month MBA. You like basically just practice running a business. It was a tight window, 6 months. There's a lot of cool alumni. The Musks are a part of it somewhere around, you know, in somewhere
Kimball Musk, Elon's brother, ran a College Pro Painters franchise in Ontario for like 2 years back in the 90s or 80s or something.
And yeah.
Fun fact.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I wanted to do that sort of stuff. I wanted to, I just wanted to try things and just keep challenging myself rather than stay stagnant. So got involved in some of those things. Did all the appointments, did the therapies, did all the stuff, right? The fact is your body's just different. You've just been smashed, right? Mm-hmm. So, that was that first year, just a lot of recovery.
Getting back into it.
Healing, just getting it, getting after it, getting on it. The first 4 months, you're basically just laid up.
So you're getting back into it. You start this painting business. You know, things are kind of on the up and up slowly, but surely, sort of. And then there's some more bad news in this story.
Yeah, so that first year of JDC, we had a really good group. We were in the entrepreneurship category, of course. And we had put together this bomb presentation. Bomb ass presentation. It was so good. So good, man. We were like fired up. We were ready to just kill it. And we got to like heading out there and they gave us a faulty USB. And so we had no deck. And we weren't talented enough to pull that off without a deck. And so it's a bit of a disaster. It's a bit of a microcosm of that season of my life, really. Like you're trying so hard, and then even something as simple as just having a usable USB drive couldn't be had.
Yeah, so. When it rains, it pours.
Exactly. So that same weekend, where we've just worked so hard for these months to try and get ready for this thing, that same weekend, my brother and I, we get a call from our parents, and my dad has cancer, and the prognosis was not good.
This is what the call is about, just to be clear. Your dad has cancer. It's not good.
Yes.
This isn't like he had cancer and you knew about it. This was,
Yeah.
So he's recovering from, because he was in the accident too.
He was. Yeah. He had other injuries. He had, like, his shoulder was blown up. He had a brain hemorrhage. And when you're 50, you don't heal
as well.
The same way. Okay. Right? And so he had a lot of stuff he was working through. He couldn't work. He was struggling with his own, you know, his identity was work.
Yeah.
And it was gone.
Yeah.
And so that news happens that weekend. This is about to, you know, this, I'm about to start running my first year of this whole college pro experience. By the way, like, that whole world is where many of the PTA.
That's where we met.
That's where we met. That's where a lot of us came from.
Yeah.
Right. Great experience, great learning. And so I'm about to start my business, and then we get this news. And so I'm wondering, you know, I mean, am I going to, should I just not do this? Should I cancel? You know, should I pause, not just wait, see what's going on? And it's such a weird thing, because you don't want to pause your life, because you're, a part of you is, you know, you believe that your dad or your family member is going to pull through.
Mm-hmm.
And a part of you thinks, if I don't do this, like, you know, what if they think I'm just, that we're just waiting around for him to die or something? Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to act like he's going to pull through, you kind of just got to keep moving.
Is where I went.
And so, you know, we made some changes. It was all for the better. Like, we switched the area that I worked in, was going to run the business in. And it was a really good thing.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out for the better.
You went back to Lethbridge, in other words.
No, actually, I ran the business. This is always nerve-wracking, but ran the business in the area I grew up.
Right.
And I decided to just use it as motivation.
Yeah.
And I wanted to try and help a little bit. You know, I wanted to try and help my parents. I wanted to, you know, give my brother and I purpose and a bit of a distraction, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we went at it. We ran the business that first year, set some rookie records that year, did well. It's the second year, you know, so they basically told my dad, you know, that he probably would have about 6 months. That was the prognosis. It ended up being closer to 18 months, but, it was that second year where he was really going through the worst of it. That was the greatest grind that I can remember. I've had lots of grinds in my life, but that one was a big one.
Worse than the accident?
I wouldn't say like more. I wouldn't call it more demanding on my body necessarily, but like just stressful.
Yeah. Dark.
Consuming, dark.
Yeah.
I remember that. So that second year, we did run the business in Lethbridge that year. And a lot of it was because our dad was there. My parents had moved there now. And that year, I mean, we would, it's this weird thing, right? You've got this like tiny window to do all this work and try and get all this stuff done, make some money, right? And my brother and I, during that time, like, we would be up 5-6 in the morning, grab something on the way out the door. We'd work all day And then we'd go to the hospital for the visiting hours in the evening. We'd have dinner at Boston Pizza, steak and potatoes, baby. And we'd get back at, you know, 11, 12, and we'd do it all again over and over and over that year, that spring and summer. And it was painful. It was nothing compared to what he was going through.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's a challenging thing because on one hand you're like, you want to be there, you want to spend time. On the other hand, you're wondering, you know, should I be there more? You know, you're like, you're just always kind of second guessing.
It's hard mental math.
Yeah.
Am I being performative by being here too much? Am I psyching him out by being around too much? Like, it's just, I think, I don't know if there's a right way to play it.
No.
There's certainly no SOP for that.
No.
And so you guys did remarkably well, in those college pro years, won a lot of awards, broke records, made a bunch of money for a young guy. But at the same time you were doing this on basically as a shell of your former self and your dad's dying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that summer, that's, you know, second year of being in business, that summer he passed away July 4th. And we were really close with our dad.
Yeah.
Me and my brother. So it was, we were told, I think on a Sunday we were told, like, you know, this is kind of it.
We're getting close.
Say your goodbyes. And that went on for 4 days. Those are the longest, worst days of my life, for sure. Being there with him for those 4 days and just saying goodbye hundreds of times, you know, and just wanting, part of you just wants it to be over so that his suffering is over, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you love him so much, but you can tell he's not really here anymore, you know? And, it was torture.
Yeah.
Those days were torture.
Really rough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember being like really enamored by you because you're a couple years older than me. And when I joined College Pro, you were winning all the records and you do these really incredible speeches at the end of the year. And I would break up about it and you'd be sort of in tears about it. And it's a very emotional story. And it's a very, I just remember always being incredibly inspired by, first of all, there was the performance. Everyone was like, oh, Ian Overkirk, like this guy's an absolute animal. Like, look at these numbers. He did this much in revenue. Look at how much his business made. And I mean, for the audience, you got to keep in mind, these are little student painting franchises. Like the business that we operate now is much bigger. The businesses we coach are much bigger. But back in the day when you're, whatever, 22,
early
26, 20s. Like you're young, you're running a $400,000 business, a $500,000 business. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, everyone was just in awe of you and your results. And I don't think anyone really knew until you kind of spoke about it publicly, which you did really eloquently, what was going on for you in the background. So that was your second year of College Pro.
Yeah.
And you got through that. You went on and did a few more really successfully. And, you know, after that, you took some time off. You and I traveled to Nicaragua together, did some stuff in Central America. We now do this BTA thing and have grown that. The rest is history. But I want to ask you, like, what the core lessons and takeaways for you as a leader, as a business person, as a man, as a husband, et cetera, what those lessons were for you and what you would share for the audience, going back to this idea of seasons and people going through really, really down cycles in their life. Like, what have you learned from that section that you think is powerful and useful for our listeners?
I think, man, there's three things, and then there's three things within one of them. But, you know, I think that you know, in these battles, in these seasons in life where you are grinding, you're not really sure what's next or what, you know, if you're going to make it or if you're ever going to be the same. I think faith is a key ingredient. I think faith is something we all need. Mm-hmm. And that's going to, you know, that can take many forms. We'll talk about that. Faith is one thing. I think perspective, keep it all in perspective. And a few things that I've learned now 16 years later that have reframed my perspective that I didn't even recognize at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing is, you know, just a little inspiration, right? There's a lot of people, especially, you know, we work with business owners, right? Business owners, I think, have this unique ability to have their voices heard because they're paying the bills.
That's right.
Right? So as that's the case, I think it's important that we recognize how powerful our voices can be. And I think if we can give a little encouragement, a little bit of inspiration to our people, a little bit of faith, I think that's a good thing for us to do as leaders and as owners.
So, let's talk about the faith thing a little bit. Like you're Christian, you're a man of faith, you always have been, always will be. We can explain this in more of this doesn't need to necessarily be a religious idea, the idea of faith. It's so unpack that. It's belief in a brighter future. It's belief that things are going to work out. Things are going to break your way. Can we kind of break this down a little?
Yeah. So one of my earliest mentors, you know, he said this to me once and it's stuck with me ever since. He said, faith is a gift. You know that, Ian? And I said, I never thought of it that way. You know, I never thought of faith as a gift. I thought we all just kind of had it.
Mm.
But, you know, the longer I live, the more I realize that it is a gift. And I think it takes many forms. It can be faith in yourself. A lot of people don't have any faith in themselves, right? It can be faith in others. Some people struggle with that. Type A's like me. We struggle with that sometimes.
Totally.
Faith in others and their ability to get things done and come through and be there for us, mm-hmm. you know? And I think faith in a higher power. For me, you know, I love my man Jesus.
I know you do.
Yes. But, you know, faith in a higher power, I think, is something we all need.
Yeah.
We don't all have it.
Yeah.
But maybe that faith takes a different form for people who don't have that, right? So I believe it so strongly. I have it tattooed on my back, man. Faith is a gift. There's so many things that happen in our journey that don't make sense.
Can you explain why faith is a gift first? Like, just unpack that. I don't think it's immediately obvious. There's something profound there, but you need to explain it.
Yeah, I think when we say when he said faith is a gift, I think he was talking about it in sort of a predestination.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, some people are chosen and, you know, they kind of have this gift of faith. I think it's something we work at.
I do too.
Yeah, I think that faith is something we work at, and it comes and goes. And yeah. And if we're looking for it, right? You can see the patterns, right? And you can see the things that, you know, just seem remarkable or miraculous, and those are exciting. And I think that's, to me, like the gift is being able to, you know, take the time, reflect, see it, capture it, meditate on it.
Yeah.
And it becomes real. And I think that to me, that's sort of what I mean anyway.
Well, one of the things that I've got really clear on somewhere in my mid-30s is the idea that beliefs are not facts. That's why they're called beliefs and they're not called facts.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and it's a really important semantic difference. So a belief is something you believe to be true, not because science proves it, not because there's evidence, not because, although in some cases there are, not because there's this incredibly sound peer-reviewed study that proves it.
Mm-hmm.
A belief is different in the sense that you hold it because it serves you.
Mm-hmm.
You choose to believe something because it makes your life better to hold that belief. And I, like in my experience, when I've lost kind of touch with that, my life really falls apart when I lose touch with a belief in a brighter future and a higher power, all that stuff. And it does come and go, and I really have to work at it probably more than other people. And I've just found that a useful framing in distinguishing between those two things. You don't need to have, you don't need to have inarguable proof for something to be a belief that works for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, man, I mean, there's power in belief, you know?
Major.
Yeah.
That's why you hold it.
And I think that it can be motivating, it can be inspiring, it can be freeing, you know, when you find it.
So for someone listening, and maybe their mom is dying, not their dad, or maybe they've gone, they're, you know,
Marriage is falling apart. Who knows what's happening?
They got a kid that's really troubled. They've got whatever. Insert problem. What would be your advice to them around faith, around belief?
I would say, I think that kind of leads into the next part, the next lesson, so to speak, is it's about perspective. And I think that, you know, that was one of the first lessons I ever learned from my dad. I'll never forget it. We were driving around. I can still tell you where it happened. And he was explaining to me, you know, one of his glory day moments in how good a shape he was in or something. And I was, you know, you're quizzing him as a kid. You're like, hey, well, you know, were you the strongest guy in town? Are you the strongest guy here and there? And well, he said I was. And then this guy half my size just dummied me on a lift, and I was forever humbled.
Yeah.
And he told me in that moment, like, it's all perspective. You know, you could be great at something in one area, and, you know, comparison's the thief of joy, right? There's always going to be someone better somewhere, somebody who thinks differently or, you know, who has you beat,
mm-hmm.
right? And so life is a game of perspective, right? And that was one of the first lessons I ever learned from him, and it was beautiful. And I still, all the time, I'm reshaping perspective. And, you know, if anyone's going through these seasons in life that are painful and hopeless,
mm-hmm.
right? I think that what I've learned now in going through many of these moments and doing a lot of reflection is usually you're gaining one of three things, I think. I think you're gaining courage,
mm-hmm.
you're gaining capacity, or consideration. Compassion, whatever you want to call it, right? To me, no matter what you're going through, you can probably see that at least one of those three things is changing for you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking for the moments, right, there's always things, you know, there's always things that you can cling to that are still unique or special or significant that don't make sense. Like there's always something, it sounds so cliche and cheesy and I hate it when people say it to me. I know, you know, but when people say like, oh, it could be worse, right? They're not wrong, even though you're pissed off about it
yeah.
when they say it. Then when you start actually diving deep into it, there's always things to be grateful for.
Well, there's that whole our mutual friend Fife, who you've yeah. met. So he always talks about, and the first time he said it, I was like, "You're such a hippie! Like, give me a break." He's like sort of dealing with crisis or dealing in these moments. He just says, you ask yourself the question and you seriously try and answer it. Where is the gift?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to look for it. Mm-hmm. In bad case scenarios, you have to really, really look for it. And it's not to make light of a bad situation. I'm all for a good sulk. I'm all for wallowing in it, as you know. But it has helped me in certain moments go, okay, well, this is completely falling apart in my life. This relationship is completely falling apart in my life. This is abject failure on every level. There's no other way to look at it. But it's a forcing function to make me get back in touch with myself, get back in touch with my self-care, get back in touch, like blah, 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 blah. You can find the GIF if you look for it, but you do have to look for it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you mean when you say it's a matter of perspective.
Absolutely. And you know, there's always things. Gratitude solves a lot of problems.
It really does.
Right. And I know in my own story, right? People don't generally walk around with scars here, right? It's like when your carotid artery gets mostly severed, like you don't live.
No.
And it so happened that an ambulance was
right there
driving by when this accident happened. Now that's
weird.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Right? The last moment I remember, right, at that gas station, I, for whatever reason, I never sat on the driver's side of the vehicle. Never, ever. I hate it. I never did. And for whatever reason, that one day, I decided, I'm going to sit here. And I sat on the side that, you know, would have been the worst possible place to be.
So you like, moved into the impact
I
zone.
I moved into the impact zone.
Oh, I thought
zone.
This was going a different
no,
way.
Man, like, no, man, no.
I moved out of the impact
no, zone. No, I was like...
Like, I think I'll try.
I think I'll try this.
I think
seat
I'll
today.
Try this side for once.
Exactly. Like, you know what? This is this.
Let
makes
me mix
sense
it
today.
Up a bit.
Let me mix it up today. This seems like the right day to do.
Nailed
this.
Nailed it.
Yeah, nailed it. And that's where I got obliterated. You know, yeah. Clearly that was meant to happen.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of moments that are miraculous in this story, and that's where I, you know, I think the faith piece comes in, or the observation, the gratitude comes in, because there are so many things that I'm thankful for, right? There was a night where the aneurysm was at its worst, and the doctor said 90% chance he'll have a stroke and be never the same, or we'll have to operate, and again, he'll never be the same. So some people heard that. They had a prayer group come together at the church. They were up at it all night and never had a stroke.
Yeah.
Never had surgery.
Yeah.
You know, these are sorts of things that you're like, okay, you know, those are pretty amazing things. And even in the worst of circumstances, there probably are good things to find if you look hard enough.
You and I talk about this all the time offline, and we talk on the phone often, and we visit each other in person often. I come to Calgary, you come to Kelowna. You and I have a very, very like vibrant friendship. And one theme that we talk about a lot is like, this is happening for me.
Yes.
Not to me.
Yes.
How on earth can you make the case that getting completely annihilated by a vehicle, dying and coming back four times, losing your pulse for 4 minutes, having to relearn how to learn, how can you make the case that that happened for you and not to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we ruminate on that a lot. You know, these things, these seasons, they're not happening to you. They're happening for you. And when I look back now, it took me a while,
yeah.
You know, but when I look back now, I can see that, you know, all of these things happened for a reason, for a purpose, for a benefit. And, you know, again, it was capacity. It's courage.
Yeah.
You know, compassion, consideration for others. And, you know, I can see looking at this, at these moments that I went through with my dad, with myself, and all of the moments in between, and all of the pain in between, and all of the tears and blood and pain in between. I can see how those three things, mm-hmm. how they came through. And capacity, right? I mean, when you have to relearn how to learn, you are essentially kind of, I mean, looking at what I do now, it makes perfect sense, right? We're constantly trying to make it stick.
Right.
Right? And help people pick up concepts and get better. There's still so much to learn. So much to learn. We haven't mastered it. I haven't mastered it by any means. But, you know, that I had to become resourceful. I had to be curious. I had to ask for help. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to... you know, reach out to experts. I had to like get extra, you know, exam concessions. I had to, you know, kind of rewire the brain mm-hmm. to where I could still pick up concepts and put sentences together and practice and embarrass myself and keep challenging to just actually have it not be easy for me, because that's what it was before, but to actually have to like be resourceful now, get creative in solving problems rather than it just being automatic, easy, right? That's a gift now.
Those are gifts.
Those are gifts, yeah.
And people know you for that, right? People know you for, you are the one of the most beloved coaches in the whole BTA environment. You have the most solid track record, the most reliable performance with your members, the best retention. This is a very, and I think we can make the case that a lot of that stuff, a lot of the gifts that you give to others came directly from this extremely traumatic and at the time, mostly awful thing that happened.
And I mean, this is a particularly dramatic season, but these seasons come up in our lives all the time, you know, and I've had many since then, right? And, you know, another thing on the capacity front. So, man, it was like one of the most heartbreaking things in my life to that point was that time in the hospital on this like knife's edge of being alive or dead. And no one came to the hospital unless they were asked, which I found particularly hurtful because I thought I had more, you know, I thought I had different relationships than that, you know? And most people are, you know, just trying to be respectful. But in my mind, I was like, man, like,
no one's down here.
Yeah, no one's coming. Like, it's weird, you know? And I realized that I had to make more capacity, more space in my life for meaningful relationships, you know? And, you know, and I have flipped the script there, man. I have gone full out in trying to get as many of those as I can in life, because that's what it's about.
Yeah.
And when you go through these times and no one shows up, it's pretty sad. And they did show up, and some of them, you know, I'm sure I just didn't know about, right? Or they asked, and my family was distracted and never got back. But it seemed to me that I was disappointed that there weren't more people there. And so I invested in that. I just went all out trying to build that in my life, because I realized it wasn't a big part of my life till then. Yeah. Right?
There's something that you talk about a lot with your members. I know because they tell me, and this is probably a good place to bring this in for a landing. Like, you talk a lot about, you mentioned it earlier, becoming an inspiration, finding a way to sort of use your voice as an entrepreneur and have an impact on people, and using that very unique role as a small business owner to be a bringer of light, a doer of good, someone that brings about goodness and growth with the people around them. So just talk a little bit about that kind of philosophy that you try to impart on the people you coach.
All right. So as business owners, you know, the things that we say, the words that we use or don't use, they have a lot of impact on people, I think. And I have, you know, these moments in life where we are learning capacity, where we're, you know, all these things, they're always teaching us something. So, you know, all these things that I went through, all these things that I've experienced, right? They all let you better understand other people and their pain, right? So you can relate to them better. So all these moments where you're going through these things that are tough, you're also learning how other people feel during these times. And there's no point trying to compare your pains, you know? I used to do that. I used to think,
who's suffering more?
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, oh well, that's, you know, and you can't compare pain because everyone goes through it, experiences everything uniquely, right? So when we're learning these things, when we're going through our own experiences, I hope we're learning some empathy for our people, right? And you know, I met up this past weekend with Ian Kent. You know, he even had him here a couple times. And, you know, he would suggest that maybe we give too much empathy to too many people. Not that he's that intense, but, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, probably need a kick in the pants as much as they need more empathy, right? Sure. So that's fair. But, you know, the other thing that all these moments are teaching us is courage, right? And I remember, you know, having to like try and help my family. And I remember like this shy, kind of introverted, timid kind of kid, you know, and I'm out 3 feet of snow pricing paint jobs and trying to convince people to like trust me with it in January when the season doesn't start till May.
Yeah.
You're learning courage, right? Yeah. You're learning courage.
You're knocking doors and
right?
The day after Christmas to try to get leads to.
Totally, man. Yeah. Like when all this happened to me, you know, I was saving myself for marriage.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I almost, in my mind, almost died an eternal virgin.
Yeah.
And that freaked me out.
Didn't
so
like
I was
that.
Like, this is not going to happen for me. So I'm going to get out there. I'm going to like be brave, you know, approach women, talk to girls.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it brought me the greatest gift of my life, probably Chelsea, right?
Yeah.
She's incredible. And so, you know, these are the things that taught me courage.
Yeah.
We're always learning these lessons, even if, you know, we're not taking the time to capture them.
Yeah.
Right? If we do, I think that's an important step.
Mm-hmm.
But all these things that you're going through, all these things that are happening, they're all teaching you, you know, they're all teaching you those, you know, courage, capacity, or some empathy,
yeah,
some consideration for others, right? And when it comes to bringing that to your people, right, I think we have a unique gift as entrepreneurs and as business owners to do that more than others,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we choose our teams.
Mm-hmm.
We choose the meeting rhythms with those team members. We choose the subject matter, right? We have so much potential in what we can bring to others, whether it's encouragement, right? A little bit of perspective. Hey, have you thought about it this way, right? Or whether it's a little bit of faith, right? Yeah. To bring that to people is so special. It's a great opportunity. And I think it's one of the most special things about being a business owner.
Why don't we wrap there? We've got a part two coming up. What are we talking about in the next one, Ian?
So we're going to go into the six core disciplines of being a business owner, being a small business owner.
That you coach.
That we coach, you know, that we've sort of, you have.
Specifically your spin on them.
Exactly. We'll go through the best things to do in each of those disciplines to get the most success the fastest.
Yep.
And we'll go through kind of what I think is a great order to process mastery or at least proficiency in those six.
Cool. So. We'll hit that next time.
Beautiful.
Thanks, buddy.
Of course, brother.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.